This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Two things as we get going today. Number one, we are already in a recession, gang. And number two, tomorrow we're going to find out how bad it's going to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 25th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there is a thing that happens when a big story like this lasts for a while. And I figure we are just about at that point now where it's happening. So it's time to clue y'all in so we all know what's going on. Everything starts to sound the same, like you've heard all the news updates before. Us, for instance. You probably heard on this program, I don't know, a half a dozen times in the last week alone that a number we are going to get tomorrow morning called first-time claims for unemployment is going to be gigantic. Maybe 2.5 million people filing claims against a normal week where it's 250,000 tops. I said that again because the big rescue bill that Congress still hasn't found a way to pass is throwing billions of dollars at unemployment insurance. But every one of those 2.5 million people who we're going to file tomorrow is a story in an unemployment system that is deeply, deeply stressed. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
So we want this to go on here?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the violin.
Last Friday was Steve Banchero's last day of work at the violin shop where he's fixed instruments for 30 years. With music performances canceled and business down, the shop's closed indefinitely.
We can do some work at home and we can do repairs, but yeah, it's not exactly a telecommuting business.
Banchero didn't apply for unemployment right away. He'd heard horror stories of the Oregon website crashing. He finally tried last night and after some initial glitches got his claim filed. Congress is sending money to the states to beef up staffing and administration, but many states make qualifying for and receiving benefits difficult, says Michael Gratz at Columbia Law School. Since the Great Recession, some states have reduced unemployment payments, and 8 states no longer offer the standard 26 weeks of benefits.
So we've got poor and inadequate finance, very inadequate coverage. It's just an archaic, ineffective system.
The Senate's new stimulus bill will send billions more to the states, says Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project.
I think this will go a long way to smoothing the transition into the next recession.
It'll pay benefits to workers staying at home to care for family members, plus the self-employed and independent contractors.
This bill also will give everyone, whether they're on the new pandemic unemployment assistance program or traditional unemployment insurance, an extra $600 a week for 4 months. That increase is huge.
Evermore says the goal is to replace workers' pre-coronavirus paychecks and make sure people remain eligible for benefits without having to go out and look for work, the last thing they should be doing during a pandemic. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Another thing that people who 2 weeks ago had jobs but now don't have, another thing they have to worry about is how they are going to get health care coverage. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
1 week ago, Sonia Zanotti was laid off from her job as a bartender in Washington, D.C. She's scrambling to apply for unemployment, figure out how she'll pay rent, and what she's going to do about health insurance since her employer stopped subsidizing it on April 11th.
Which is probably the scariest part of it for me, because we're going into a pandemic.
She figures she'll get insurance on the healthcare exchange, but in the past, that's cost her $400 a month for a plan with a $4,000 deductible. She hasn't figured out if she'll qualify for Medicaid, but for now, COBRA is just too expensive.
I don't think I've ever been this scared about my financial situation before.
But at least her former employer has paid for insurance for the next month. That's what Asher Schofield is doing for five former employees of his shuttered gift shop, The Frog and Toad, in Providence, Rhode Island.
Not being covered at a time like this is very scary, and we just want to make sure that everybody's taken care of through this.
But even before the pandemic, more than 27 million people in the U.S. had no insurance. That includes many part-time, freelance, and gig workers who don't get health care or other benefits through an employer, but might not qualify for public assistance.
What is transpiring now is underscoring the critical need for us to refashion the social safety net.
NYU business professor Arun Sundarrajan says the reliance on traditional full-time employers to deliver safety net benefits for workers was breaking down long before the current crisis. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There was a big rally today on Wall Street on news that that economic rescue package was going to get done, and then it didn't get done. Still up, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. These have been an interesting couple of weeks in the markets. Stocks, of course, but also, as we have dipped in and out of just a bit on this program, bonds. And generally speaking, as bonds go, so go mortgages. And with rates generally falling, mortgage brokers have been getting a whole lot of calls. So we called Vivian Geller. She's at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles, also a mortgage broker. Vivian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Interesting times in a lot of ways in this economy. Before things got really serious with the virus, though, we were seeing mortgage rates fall, and I imagine you were crazy busy.
Yes, for a couple of weeks we were slammed. The 10-year Treasury note fell below one, as you know, likely. And so for about a week, week and a half, we were slammed, and then the index fell even lower. But surprisingly, the rates shot up after that point.
Was that demand, but just people coming in and saying, I need a mortgage, please, please, please?
I think it was both. I think it was initially demand, and then it was followed by uncertainty. And then, of course, it was followed by, you know, the lack of investors. We saw basically, you know, no place for mortgage-backed securities go.
Right.
So the market just fell out. Like, literally, it fell out overnight.
So I don't want to get too weedy here, but I mean, you know, we could talk mortgage-backed securities all day, but fundamentally, the Federal Reserve has now stepped in and is providing liquidity in virtually every aspect of its operations. What is that doing to the mortgage market? Is it helping you out at all? Is it easier now to get a mortgage for those who still want to buy a house?
Not yet. You know, surprisingly, we haven't seen that happen yet. For very standard, you know, Freddie Fannie 30-year fixed rates, those are still competitive for purchases. But anything beyond that, no go. I think it may be a little bit of time before we see the investors come back on those products.
Right. We should explain here. What happens is you get a mortgage, and then that mortgage gets sold into a securitization market, right? Investors buy that, and that provides liquidity for more mortgages, right? There's a trickle-down effect, right? That's kind of the way it goes.
Exactly. And the government is pouring trillions into the economy right now, and they've basically assured banks, we're going to give you the money you need. But I think that we're just still in a state of panic right now. Mm. Hopefully within the next week or so, we'll see things calm down. At least that's what, you know, I'm hoping.
Yeah, as are we all, right? What are the people who call you looking for mortgages telling you? What's their mindset?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, right now I'm getting a lot of calls from people that have lost their jobs or are really nervous and want to take cash out of their property.
Wow.
A lot of equity lines as well. So it's a little tough because Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, you know, are now putting extra due diligence around verifying people's income and their employment. It's going to be tough until we start to see some relief programs come out, which I hope will happen soon for a lot of these people.
Right. Freddie and Fannie, of course, the two big government-backed mortgage companies. Are you seeing a lot of homes that have been in contract then just fall out of escrow, too? Are you seeing that?
Yeah, a couple. Not too much, but we have seen them here. A few because the lenders backed out. I think the market's going to kind of be at a standstill for the next few weeks because it's just hard to even go see a house and get an offer accepted.
Right, for sure. For sure. Weeks, I think, you know, sort of seems optimistic the way things are going. But that leads to this next and last question, which is how long can this go before damage is done to the real estate market, before house prices really fall, people feel it in their worth and all of that?
Well, you know, based on everything I've read, the real estate market should hold steady. Personally, I don't know if I believe that. I think that I'd say within, if I had a guess, I'd say 3 to 4 weeks, and we're going to start to see, you know, values in real estate drop. That's just my personal guess. We'll bounce back, hopefully sooner rather than later, but it is going to be a very, very, very tough next few months for everyone across the board, not just in real estate, but virtually every single industry here in the U.S. and worldwide.
Vivian Geller, she's a mortgage broker, and she's the CFO at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles. Vivian, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Kai. Take care. Good luck.
Might have seen some reports the other day that the Trump administration is thinking about deferring tariffs for 90 days on a whole bunch of imports. No country specified, by the way, in case you were wondering about the trade war with China. Anyway, those were the reports. The on-the-record denial came from Peter Navarro, the president's main trade advisor. He called them, those reports, that thing the White House likes to say about news that it doesn't like. Starts with an F. You take it from there. But on the theory that we are early yet in this recession, and economic relief of all kinds will become more attractive the longer it goes, we thought it might be a good idea to see what might happen if tariffs did, in fact, go away. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
Tariffs are taxes on U.S. businesses and consumers. We pay them. The president says China pays them, but we do. We do. For some Americans, this is a win.
A lot of those duties are in place because those imports were found to be subsidized and otherwise unfairly traded, and that they're injuring American companies.
Michael Stumo is head of the Coalition for a Prosperous America.
We don't want to reduce them or delay them because they would re-injure companies that are increasingly injured now.
But economists from the Federal Reserve to the private sector have compared how much economic benefit the tariffs have brought with how much economic pain they have created.
Tariffs create more losers than winners.
Dan North is senior economist for North America for Euler Hermes, which provides trade credit insurance.
That is probably costing something like, in terms of GDP, 0.3% to 0.5%. So it is a significant drag, especially in this environment.
Suspending tariffs and the lower prices that could result might not get people out of their homes and making major purchases now, but it might later, and businesses would benefit from increased cash flow. Mary Lovely is professor of economics at Syracuse University and says suspending the tariffs would target U.S. manufacturers who depend on imports in order to make their goods.
The tariffs cost firms about $900 per worker per year. So you can think of it as an easy way to put $900 per worker back in the companies that are employing those workers.
And Lovely says if China reciprocated, it would help U.S. farmers who export to China. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Quick plug here before I forget. Our newsletter, more and different stuff on all the business and economic news of these disquieting times. Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you go. Coming up,
the Census Bureau actually is trying to recruit people to work in their own zip codes.
And as you might imagine, that is not the only challenge right now, trying to count every person in this economy. But first, Sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 495 today, 2.3%, 21,200. The NASDAQ down 33 points, 0.4%, 7,384. The S&P 500 increased 28 points, 0.1%, landed at 2,475. That mixed markets music, by the way, haven't heard that in a good long while. Megan was talking about workers who lose jobs and health insurance coverage. Well, so here you go. Cigna up 6.5% today. Humana boosted 14.9%. Attorneys general, from across the country asking online sales and retail companies to monitor price gouging. Amazon down 2.7% today. Walmart slumped 4.8%. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yield goes up. 10-year T-note at 0.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've been hearing a lot over the past couple of weeks, mostly because we've been telling you, I guess, about the disruption that this economy right now is bringing to people who work in the service sector. Bartenders and ticket takers, barbers, those kinds of jobs. As we learned in our series that we started last month, the United States of Work, they're nearly 2 out of every 10 workers in the American labor force. And one of the 10 people that we've been talking to in that series is Ashley Nelson. She's a hairstylist in Boise, Idaho, who when we called her just for a regular check-in last week, she was still working then. Now she is not and does not know when she will again. Ashley, it's good to talk to you one more time.
Good to talk to you too, Kai.
So, first question is, how you doing?
I've been doing okay. It's been a bit of a crazy week. Lots changed in a week. So, yeah, it's been pretty crazy.
Yeah. Tell me about, so you have stopped taking clients and working at the salon. It's been like a week or so now you've done that. What was your decision process like? Because this is your business. It's your livelihood.
Yeah, it was a really tough decision to make. There wasn't anything mandated by like the state or the governor or anything. But I was just seeing my fellow colleagues and friends across the country doing what they had to do to take care of the community around them. Even though I'm an independent contractor, I actually work in a salon for people. And mm-hmm. So they weren't making that decision. So I kind of had to just take it into my own hands. It was a tough, really tough decision being that, like, you know, I don't get paid. I don't get unemployment. I don't get any of that. So,
yeah, you, I want to read you a little bit of your Instagram post on this from whatever it was, a week maybe or so ago. You said, and this is you now, I'm the problem. As a hairstylist, I was drawing people out into the public and not helping the issue. That's pretty sobering.
Yeah, it was hard to be at work that last day that I worked and watched all the people that were coming in and bringing their children in. I mean, like I said in that post, there was like a 90-year-old lady that came in that was more concerned about her hair than her health. And so, yeah, I just got to a point where I was feeling like I was getting scared, you know, and I didn't want to mm-hmm. be the problem.
Which is, I mean, look, it's the right thing to do. It's hard. I get it. But now you are without an income, right? And you're going to have a mortgage payment due and probably a car payment or something. How are you going to get by?
You know, what's funny is you mentioned those things, and those are definitely at the top of my list of concerns. But as an independent contractor, I actually have to pay to be at work.
Yeah. So when you say you have to pay to go to work, you mean you rent the chair in the salon and all of that, right? Your supplies and everything?
Yeah. You have to rent the chair. And, you know, if you take a vacation, you still have to pay for a certain amount of days, no matter what. So we actually pay to be on vacation. So that's probably my biggest concern right now, is wondering if while I'm not at work because the salon is closed down, is if I still have to pay.
Yeah. And there are hairstylists who are not as doing as well as you, and they have to make the same decision, right?
Yeah, and that's the people that, you know, like I have the means to pay for my lease while I'm gone, But I don't think that's the case for everybody. I mean, if you're a mom or if you're worrying about paying for your rent so you have a home to go to, but then you have to pay for the workspace that you're not actually able to go to and make money, that's where it gets a little bit difficult for people that work for themselves.
Right. If this goes, let's say, 2 months, right, you're going to be okay? You're going to be able to get by?
Yeah, I will be okay, me personally. But I know when I get back to work, I'll be working probably 6 to 7 days a week to get back in order. So that's going to be crazy.
Let me ask you this, though. As you think about starting up again, would you think about lowering prices to get people back in the chair? Or are you confident in your order book that people are going to be coming to see you?
I'm confident in my order book. I don't think that I will be lowering any prices. I think that, if anything, this is a wake-up call to hairstylists that we need to be charging what our worth is. Because we have to think about all this time. We don't get paid for, like I said, sick leave, vacations, anything extra. So we have to be able to make that up, you know, with our services. So I stand strong with my prices. So,
Ashley Nelson, she's a hairstylist up in Boise, Idaho, one of the 10 people we're talking to as part of our series, United States at Work. Ashley, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon, huh?
Thank you so much, Kai. You too.
Bit lost in the news fire hose of the past however long it's been is the 2020 census. The Census Bureau suspended its field operations the other day, but with billions of dollars in federal funding at stake, not to mention the constitutional requirement, the count goes on. So the Bureau is asking people to send its surveys back in the mail or online, and it's contacting people on the phone too. But in parts of Detroit, there are a whole lot of people without internet. There's a lot of poverty in that city, and people can just be harder to reach as well. And that makes Detroit one of the hardest big cities in the country to count. From WDET in Detroit, Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
The Census Bureau always planned to go door to door to reach those who had not responded. The head of the Bureau, Stephen Dillingham, says that's still the plan, but workers won't be knocking on doors until May at the earliest.
We still will be using the census takers to go through the neighborhoods, and we will adapt to the necessary health practices. We're monitoring it each and every day with the federal, state, and local officials, and we will have a very safe way in which we can still count the people that may not have self-responded.
The Bureau is training workers in how to practice social distancing and providing safety equipment. But the executive director of Detroit's 2020 census campaign, Vicky Kovari, says some Detroiters don't trust giving out personal information, especially to the federal government. She says it may take more than just contacting people safely to convince them to participate. It may take hearing from someone they identify with.
The Census Bureau actually is trying to recruit people to work in their own zip codes. It's absolutely preferable to have people work in those areas where there are familiar faces.
Just explaining what the census is can be vital. Some people say they've heard the term, but how much do they actually know about it?
Nothing.
That's horrible, though.
Detroit security guard Marquita Aldridge says she tries to guard her private affairs as securely as she does City Hall. She's not keen about opening up her life to a stranger.
When it comes to the address, you know, your home is sacred. So definitely going to be like, I don't know you. And, you know, you might be asking a little bit too much personal questions.
Some groups in Metro Detroit have been trying to ease those fears in their own neighborhoods long before census workers even begin approaching a door. Detroit has a large Muslim population. Some imams have been stressing to people in their communities just how much federal funding depends on them taking the census. But Chris Blauvelt of Wayne State University's Islamic Center of Detroit says some Muslims are reluctant to even register to vote, let alone provide information to census workers, because they fear immigration officials are targeting some in their community for deportation.
I think it's only natural if you're an immigrant. It's natural to be afraid and suspicious of this administration.
But Blauvelt says it's a bit more reassuring talking with someone who shares their culture.
If another Arab American immigrant walked to my door, and explained to me, no, the census is not going to affect you. There's no risk at all. And this will help ensure that our community gets the government aid that we deserve. That means obviously a lot more.
The Census Bureau is actively encouraging people who are bilingual to apply for jobs to go door-to-door, saying it needs people who speak the language of the neighborhoods they're going to work in. In Detroit, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, just in case you weren't clear as to how serious this crisis is, in which we learn Waffle House is closing something like 400 of its restaurants. Now, before you say, wait, Kai, Waffle House? What? Perhaps you have never heard of the Waffle House Index, an informal yet very real measurement used by the Federal Emergency Management Agency to gauge how bad a natural disaster is going to be. The thinking being that if Waffle House, famous for being open 24/7 come hell or high water, if Waffle House is closing in big numbers, that's not great. Now, why any Waffle House is open for anything other than takeout? Well, that's a whole nother question. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 495 today, 2.3%. The NASDAQ actually lost 33 points, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 28 points, 0.1% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.